All right, so the topic this evening is about loss, and this is a topic that I've spent a lot of time reflecting on and thinking about and living in the last 5 years. I've had, like many of us of my age, I've had a series of deaths of people that are really, really dear and close to me, that were seminal in my life. I've lost a significant relationship, perhaps the one of the most relationships I've had in my life. I have had both my knees replaced. I'm losing my hair. It's inevitable, you know. No way to fool myself that somehow I have any semblance of youth, other than my mind feels like it keeps getting younger because of this practice. Yeah. You know, big financial losses, you know, and the downturn of the economy. So for me, really looking at this, I'm glad all of these things happened at the stage of my practice that they happened. Mm-hmm. Because I feel like I've been able to be there for them. And in the case of the death of my mother, which was, she had this like slow illness that she was dying from, and then there was kind of like this catastrophic thing that happened that no one expected, and she was in intensive care and died in 8 days, just like boom, you know. And I was able to, like, because of this practice, you know, and all the work, I was able to, like, really be there for her. And I was fortunate that I had someone in my life, a parent, who from the minute I was aware of anything, and from that moment forward, I knew that there was someone that unconditionally cared for me. Mm-hmm. A real gift. And I felt like in those 8 days I was able to really be there for her and in some way pay her back. You know, I was like, it's kind of extraordinary experience. So, like, from one perspective, like you were saying, you know, from one perspective, it's almost horrific. And from another perspective, I can say that those 8 days with her may have been the sweetest 8 days I've had in my life. You know, and I attribute it to this practice. You know, being able to actually be there for the experience and not being caught in all of the drama. You know, like, no, actually being there for her, you know. So what I'd like to do tonight is talk about understanding and experience and working with loss from a Buddhist perspective. And it doesn't matter what the cause of the loss is. You know, it doesn't matter whether it's poor decision making, deluded, you know, from a Buddhist perspective, deluded decision making, and then you end up paying some terrible price for bad decisions, you know, a completely unexpected thing that happens, an automobile accident. I'm not sure that I mentioned this, but I had this incident with my grandson, who's 26 months years old, and he was up on, he has his favorite way he likes to play, on top of the sink in my kitchen. Mm-hmm. And he's got this little, we have this little, it's kind of like a bread box, but it's bigger, you know, that rolls up, and he just loves that. So I let him get up there, and usually I'm right behind him. So of course, the minute I'm not, you know, he falls off, you know, and what is that, about 3.5 feet? And we have tile, you know, so he's not falling on a carpet. And he fell like completely flat. It was like a miracle. And it was this sickening thud. And I thought, oh, see, you know. And I don't know how it happened, but when he fell like perfectly flat on his hips and his whole back. His head didn't even hit the floor. Wow. Like a miracle, okay? And that could have been a disaster, right? You know, like everything's going, boy, I'm having a wonderful day with my little grandson, and then all of a sudden, you know, boy, he got brain damage or something. Or it's just the, you know, inevitable loss that we know is coming and that we try to deny. You know, that, I mean, we There's all these things we know that are coming, you know. So, you always hear me say that if we go back to fundamentals, that we've got a place to start. And I think the most fundamental aspect of Buddhist practice, and as how it applies here, is that the Buddhist approach to things is deconstructional. And what I mean by that is we have an initial impression of something, a person, an event, and in this case, a loss. And it looks like this big thing. It looks like one thing. And because it looks like one thing and it's big, it feels overwhelming. So what the Buddhist practice is to dive down below that, to look into kind of its component parts, which is what we're going to do. And this is what we call clear seeing. Okay. Now, clear seeing, from a Buddhist perspective, isn't Western psychological evaluation. It's actually diving down into what is the causation of suffering from loss. And if we can see that clearly, it begins to answer the question, how can I be skillful? Okay, so everybody get that? This is like critical, because the clear seeing and figuring out how to be skillful are related. If we're not seeing clearly, any answer we come up with, we're going to suffer. Okay? That's the formula. Right? Okay. So, okay, so suffering looks like a thing. And there's many ways to approach this, but for purposes of tonight, I'm going to break it out this way, that there's actually four things happening with suffering, and it's the reason that it makes it so painful. I'm not saying this is the cause. We're going to talk about that. But what makes it so painful? Okay. The first thing is just the process of loss itself. So unless it's just an immediate, you know, an automobile accident, a heart attack, something like that, most losses, you know, happen over a period of time. You know, so somebody gets sick and it drags on for a period of time. You know, I slowly age, and the end of my aging process, like my uncle, it's, you know, it's a mess. There is a slow deterioration in a relationship, and then the relationship breaks apart. So there's this length of time, and that process itself is painful, okay? Because the loss is unfolding. Okay. So does that work? Okay. The second one is the loss of a physical presence. So someone's gone because they died, or they left, or because there's been a betrayal in a friendship. And so physically, that just is no longer there. And it's not going to come back either. Okay. And so there's a whole kind of pain associated just with the physicality of it, you know? Like someone close dies to you, you know, the a spouse, a child that lived with you. You wake up in the morning, you go out in the kitchen, they're not there. Just the physicality becomes an issue. Okay? The next thing is our relationship with whatever it is that we have lost. So that could be a person, they're not there anymore. It could be a belief or an idea that we have. You know, that we thought that someone was a certain kind of person, or we thought that we belonged to an organization and that we were safe in the organization. And something happens, and suddenly we don't feel that any longer. We suddenly feel like, well, that person isn't the person who I thought they were. Maybe they never were. Maybe we realize we were deluded, you know. Something happens and I don't feel safe anymore. And I'm not gonna feel safe again as a result of what happened. So this relationship piece is critical. You know, like we were saying, you know, depending on how you're holding the relationship, and holding is another word, or holding the event, holding is another word for relationship. Everything flows out of that. Okay. So we've got the process itself, we've got the physicality, we have the relationship, and then we have identity. And what is frequently overlooked is when we lose something significant, we lose part of our identity. It wouldn't be significant if it wasn't part of our identity. So, I'm the person who, my grandchild, I'm the person who is a loving grandfather. Now I get to be the grandfather who caused brain damage to my grandchild, you know? Or I am the person who for 92 years had a loving uncle that supported me in everything I did. And that doesn't exist anymore. I'm not that person. You know, I don't have any adult supervision anymore. So, you know, any big loss has something to do with your identity. And if it's a primary relationship, you know, like with a spouse, the loss of a spouse is just huge in terms of who your identity is. You know, because I'm the person who for X number of years has been the person, the spouse of this person. You know, there's this whole identity around that. So there's these four components. So why is this? Why is there so much suffering? Okay, we've talked about it a little bit, but I want to put it in a context. So the first is what is attachment. You know, there's the Four Noble Truths, and the Four Noble Truths say that craving is the origin of suffering. But what is the origin of craving? The origin of craving or desire, aversion, is attachment. I'm attached to something. So this attachment is everything. You know, so I'm attached to a relationship, and we can go back to those four things. First of all, I'm attached to a process where I don't want things to be painful, gain or loss, pleasure or pain. So something starts happening. You know, like my aunt, who was always this just delightful person who I was responsible for, I was caring for her and her estate and her person. At 92, she was clear as a bell. At like, I don't know, 92 and 3 months, it's like somebody flipped a switch, mm-hmm. and she just like, her cognitive skills just went downhill within 6 months. She turned into a person that I didn't know, and a person who was unhappy, resentful, bitter, angry, and abusive. Like shocking, right? So for that to happen and then to happen so quickly, it is like, man, what an adjustment, you know? And I was really attached, you know, after my entire life, you know, to the person who was just this sweet, supportive person. And then, so, you know, so there's the distress of the situation itself, but then why it's so distressful is my still being attached to the person that I knew all my life and not being willing to somehow accept that the changes happen. And it's the attachment and the lack of acceptance which leads to everything, because to the degree that we can't begin accepting it, and accepting it like metta, accepting it unconditionally, there is no basis for moving forward. Without this unconditional acceptance, it blocks everything. It blocks the healing. It blocks a new vision of yourself. It even blocks your being present for the suffering of the other person. If I'm so caught up, I'm quite willing to admit this. This was for 2 years just a struggle for me, is that I was so aversive of being with her. And the fact that I was so aversive was just really painful. And it really took me a long time to get it, what was going on. And then just being willing, just to fall into the reality, the new reality of her life and my life, and then to the degree that I could, be with that person, you know, and really support her. And once that happened, then everything changed. Mm-hmm. Everything changed at that moment. And it's actually was that a kind of experience. It was like, once that shift happened, and this is what you're saying, is attachment intellectual. It's much more than that. It, you know, it's an entire whole body experience. You know, you can just feel the shift in your mind and your body and an opening. You know, then you can actually open to the situation that's there. And until that attachment diminishes and the acceptance sets in, you can't do that opening. That opening is blocked. Okay. So first is attachment, okay, attachment and accept. The second, and this, I think we're so caught in the suffering that we don't recognize this, is that it's the uncertainty and the confusion and the struggle of being disorganized and being disoriented by the loss. You know, so we're kind of thinking, well, you know, I'm so shook up by the loss and everything. Well, that's one piece of it. But there's this whole other piece, like, I'm just like completely disorganized psychologically and emotionally as a result of this loss now, and I'm just disoriented. And why this is important, why from a Buddhist practice we pierce this apart, is that if what I think the only problem is that I've lost something, I'm gonna work on it in one way, right? If I realize that there's this whole other component that, man, this just took me apart at some level. And it does. It's inevitable with a major loss. I mean, like, and we even, you'll say to people, well, how's it going? And they'll say, well, I'm trying to hold things together. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's like, no, I mean, I am disorganized, you know. I am disoriented. And that's okay. You know, in fact, it's one of the potential gifts of a loss, is recognizing that this is happening, and then rather than just trying to fend it off and keep it together, to actually open to it. Because there's something on the other side of it. You know, denying it and fending it off is denying and fending off a natural thing that's happening in the body and the mind. Okay? So the second thing that's happening is this whole disorganization that takes place. And the third thing, and once again, I think that this is, you know, we miss this. I've gotten over the loss, time heals all wounds, whatever. Is that actually there's a significant loss of our identity. And so that there is a whole healing from that and a birthing into a new identity or some part of our identity that doesn't involve having whatever was lost in our life. Now it's just a memory that can nourish us, but it's not in our life anymore. There's not a physical presence. There's not a relationship presence. So there's this third element. So how can we work with this skillfully? Okay. So I think the first thing, John mentioned it, is that the willingness to investigate and fully experience whatever is arising completely without fending it off is just essential. And it's, you know, the basic model of Buddhist practice, right? Just like to be there with it, whatever the emotion is, examine it carefully, experience it fully. Because if we don't do that, if we try to stuff all of that, it's coming back later. No way around it. And so it's, from a Buddhist perspective, the most fundamental part of the healing process. And then as part of that, to watch what the mind's doing. Because what the mind is going to want to do is not experience it. I mean, we have enough trouble opening to our experiences and feeling in everyday life, much less with big losses. Okay? So watching for you know, the reactivity and aversion. I mean, this was like with my aunt situation. I was so aversive, I couldn't even see that I was aversive. I mean, I'd start getting aversive 4 or 5 miles from the facility where she was. You know, I'd start getting so aversive, like I would not want to drive and park, and so identified with it that I would just caught up in, oh, this is so terrible, right? So then you just keep working with that, and your mind starts to settle, and you start to see it clearly. You don't see it clearly, you can't work with it. And then also with all the kind of projection that goes on. Like, the other piece for me that was really troubling where my aunt was you know, if you go into any skilled nursing facility in this city or any city in the United States, what you'll find is that the majority of people who were there on a long-term basis are women, older women. And I would walk down the hall. I had to go down 1, 2, 3 large, long halls to get to my aunt's room. And there were just like row after row after row of these elderly women in wheelchairs sitting there, you know. And some of them were in dementia, and some of them weren't, and some of them were asleep, and some of them would talk to each other. And this kind of became a gauntlet for me, a gauntlet of suffering. And I dreaded, you know, I started, is there some other way I can get to her room? I'm not joking. It's like, I wonder if they'll let me in the emergency room in the back of the building, which was only like 5 rooms away from her her room, you know. And so I just kept looking at that, you know, and then what I finally got was that my mind was projecting out onto every one of these elderly women what terrible suffering they were in. Mm-hmm. And I realized I didn't have a clue if they were suffering or not. And so then so I got that. Okay, I could see that clearly. So then what I started doing is investigating that. And I'd walk down the hall and, you know, I'd talk to people, you know. And there were some people, you know, who were obviously in dementia or Alzheimer and just as happy as a clam. Yeah. Right? They're just eternally in the now and we're fine and, you know. And there were other people who really didn't know. I mean, they were, you know, completely disoriented. And I don't think they were suffering, because they were just, you know, so disoriented. And then there were some people who were terribly suffering. Just like, it felt like every minute. But that experience is like really different than walking down a hall and thinking every person there is kind of like in a living hell, right? You know? So we actually start to look at, through our willingness just to be with our experience rather than managing it or trying to control it or anything else, just investigating it, then what happens? Insight arises. It's like somehow, you know, your mind gets clear. I don't have a clue if these people are suffering or not. It's completely a fabrication on my part. You know. So I'm not seeing clearly. So let's investigate. So this is difficult. You know, this is the most difficult part about practice, the willingness to be with things without changing them, seeing into them deeply. And then after you see them deeply, then you work with them. You know, then maybe you make all kinds of modifications. But until you have that clarity, if you try to do something, manage them, you're going to get the wrong answer. Okay. And then this is where you're talking about accepting things, okay? And, you know, much the same here is that actually as a focus of our attention, just watching, well, why am I suffering? We just keep watching that. And then pretty soon you do see that it's attachment, because you can feel attachment in your body. I mean, you can... has this constriction to it and everything. So you'll think of a really pleasant memory of someone who's died that you're suffering about. And you know, you'll feel this kind of melting sensation. And then you think about they're not here any longer. And everything contracts. So you can actually feel it's all energetic. I mean, you know, all of these mind states are energetic. So you begin watching that, and you just keep watching for what is the actual cause of my suffering? You know, if we're just, quote, meditating, I'm not sure where that goes. But if you're meditating to understand your experience, which is the experience of suffering, then you begin to see things. And in the end, you know, the story of the Buddha, which everybody thinks is a fable, but I don't think it is, and even if it is, it's really powerful, is that there were four heavenly messengers, okay? So he went out, he saw somebody that was sick, he saw somebody that was aging, and he saw somebody that was dead. What was the fourth thing that he saw? He saw a mendicant. He saw a monk. And why was that significant? I mean, why is this story that we all know, why is it significant? It has to do with attachment. So what happens when you're a monk or a nun? You know, you walk in to the monastery and you're dressed like me, and they say, okay, hey, you know that whole getup that you've got on that's part of your identity? Okay, take them off and put on these robes that look like everybody else's. Okay, they sit down on the chair. You know that hairdo that you spend so much time looking in the mirror? Just make sure it looks right. Okay, let's get rid of that. Cut that off. You know the wallet you brought in with you and your wristwatch? Okay, get rid of those. And here's a begging bowl. Okay, you know all that food that you really like? You know, you have all those preferences and everything? Yeah. Forget about those. Okay. So what is the symbol, what is the significance of the mendicant, the monk? And the significance is a peace which is not dependent on external circumstances or attachments. I can have deep preferences, I can love people, I can do all these things, but I don't have these deep attachments that cause me to suffer. And when you're able to do that, the type of relationship and affection and love you have is unlimited. We can't imagine, most of us, we're so identified and constricted and attached. We can't imagine what the kind of peace and affection and care is that the Buddha was talking about. And you only start to even get a glimpse of it until you have these experiences where the attachments, some of your deep attachments and some of your deep identifications start to fall away. And you see that there's a whole other thing on this side of how we understand the world that is so much bigger and deeper and kind and loving. So that's the meaning of that. And then the last piece of this piece is really realizing that you're losing an identity or a part of your identity, and that you're actually birthing a new identity. I mean, and that's a practice all of itself, you know, and it's, you know, the symbol of the phoenix, you know, flying to Egypt and going into the fire, the crucible, and burning, and then out of that arising again as a new bird, you know, is what happens with deep loss, disorientation, disorganization, disintegration, and then we put ourselves back together again. So that's part one, what we do. Part two and is how we do it. And the message of Buddhist practice is how we practice, how we do what we do, may in some ways be as important as what we do. Because what mindfulness is about is paying careful care and attention to the degree that we can, as long as we can, from moment to moment, right? So everything, potentially, becomes a work of art, or a poem, or a meditation, or a sacred act. And I had a really powerful experience of this recently. And 2-3 weeks ago, I went up and put on a one-day retreat at a Mountain Stream Meditation Center. And you drive on the grounds, and it's palpable, the deep care and concern of that Sangha and their pride that they've been able to pull off getting that building and take care of it. I mean, everything about the grounds are beautiful and manicured and orderly. The whole place is a meditation. And, you know, you walk in and there's many volunteers that greet you. You know, there's a coordinator for the day, and there's somebody who's for organizing everything, and there's somebody for cleanup. And I mean, like, they want to be involved. They are so proud of this. And they care about it. I mean, they really care about it, so they pay attention. And you walk into the Dharma Hall, you know, same thing. The Dharma Hall is so beautiful. And it's not beautiful because it's extravagant or, you know, some big Thai temple that you see in Thailand. It's because of the care and the attention, you know. So that leads me to what you were talking about, and that is Varanasi. And I'm going to, if it's okay, and if you have to go, it's okay with me, but I'm going to go over a little bit, probably 10 minutes, okay? Last year, the group of us went on a pilgrimage and moving retreat to Thailand, India, and Nepal, and we're going on another one, if anybody's interested, at the end of next year. And one of the big reasons, one of the main events for me, one of the main experiences is to go to Varanasi, which is the holiest of all holy cities for Hindus, and it's where they have these very famous burning ghats that you see in a lot of National Geographic type pictures, where you're cremated right on the Ganges, and there's one, the biggest and the most famous, where if you're a Hindu, where you want to die. You know, the belief is that if you can be cremated there, that you will be guaranteed a favorable rebirth, because they believe in transmigration of a soul. Okay. So we stay at a little hotel on the water that's probably, 1,500 yards from this burning ghat. So this is in the old part of the city, and some of the streets, you know, are from here to that wall. You know, so if you take the train in, you have to get on a bus to go to a train to taxi stations, and then the taxis take you down to the old city, and then that's it. You've got to walk in the dark to the hotel, and there's no streetlights. So you've got these things on. So when we arrived, there was a festival with an additional 10,000 people, all of whom were going to be down on the water. So we couldn't even get down to that area. So we came in on a boat, you know, riding down the river in complete darkness, and we come up upon this most famous of burning ghats, and there are slots for 21 bodies being burnt simultaneously. That's a full house. And there's 21 bodies burning all at the same time in pitch darkness. There's no lights at all on the burning ghats themselves. So just spectacular, you know, it's breathtaking, you know. So a big part for me would be to go down there, you know, we get together as a group and process the day, and then I go down and spend time there at night. And what you start to see is that there is this order and respect, and you know, the bodies are brought in to be burned there. You have to be brought there within 24 hours of dying, or you can't have your body burned there. So the family anoints cleans the body. They're carried in on, you know, stretcher kind of things. They're brought down, they're put in the Ganges and ceremonially bathed, and then they wait to get a spot, and then the family members all participate in the event. So, you know, the funeral pyre of wood is already constructed. They come in and they put the body on it, and there's this whole ceremonial thing involving the oldest male in the family, where they shave their head and they wear kind of a loin's cloth, and they circle the body, they light it, and then as the body's burning, all of the family members are participating in making sure that the fire is working and, you know, the various ceremonial things. So it's not like going to a funeral with us, where everybody's standing back here and watching it. I mean, everybody's actually gets it all going, and then everybody sits back in the dirt, and then the eldest son makes sure that the fire keeps going, and then after about 3 hours, when there's just the skeleton left, and it's pretty much just the head and the skull's there, and the oldest male takes a striker, about like this big, about 5-6 feet tall, and they crack the skull open, and the belief is that that liberates the spirit, and then everybody gets up and leaves. You know, it's not like, oh, we've got to bury the body, or we've got to save something, or we've got to get a piece of the bone, or we've got to get it. And it's like, it's over, you know? And this entire time, no one's crying. This is the striking thing for me, you know? And one night, when I was up there by myself, I had gotten to become really friendly with one of the caretakers there. And after about 9 o'clock, unless you know somebody, they won't let you into the site if you look like me. And so I would get there and he would let me in, and he actually had me sit with the family. So, you know, I mean, imagine in the West, right, that it was like, hey, can I sit in on your funeral? You know, but they were really proud to have someone from, you know, a country as powerful as ours, and they understood that I was a pilgrim, actually sit with them, you know. And and the burning body is from here to that door, you know. So for 3 hours, I'm there with the family. And what I really got from that experience was that the suffering, the liberation of the suffering of the person who was dying, was more important than the loss, the suffering to the individual. That rather than, oh my gosh, this is so terrible for me, it was just the reverse. It was like, I am so happy for the person who is dying. So I think that this is profound because, you know, Buddhist practice is really about, in the end, uprooting the narcissism that is the inherent part of the human mind, and particularly in the West, you know, because it's much stronger here, because we have this idea that, you know, you too, young man, can, you know, go West, young man, you too can be president, and there's no limits. So our narcissist system is even more powerful than in other parts of the world. And so it's a profound question, and I think it's at the core of this suffering issue. Like, why am I really suffering? And frequently the answer is because I'm viewing it as my loss. And the fact that somebody else is liberated from some suffering that they've been going through for 8 or 10 years, not even a thought. It's completely secondary. So all of these practices that we have that are aimed towards that, you know, metta expanding your heart, and then all these practices about identity, on the issue of loss become huge. Okay. So the final piece, and then I'll let you go, is that the interesting thing from a Buddhist perspective about loss is that almost all loss is foreseeable. And, you know, when I said that in the law, they say that if you know something's coming and you don't do something about it, that it's deliberate ignorance or reckless disregard. Well, I think that, like most of our lots, is this way. So there is a thing called the five daily recollections, which are used around the world. And you can use them as a recitation, as you would do in metta, or you can use them as a reflection, you know, where you really reflect on them as part of your meditation track. So I'm just going to end by reading these. Okay. So the five daily recollections. I am of the nature to age and grow old. There is no way to escape aging and growing old. I am subject to ill health and infirmity. There is no way to escape ill health and infirmity. I am of the nature to die. There is no way to escape my death. Everyone and everything dear to me is subject to change and will disappear. There is no way to escape being separated from them. I am the heir of my intentions, thoughts, and actions. There is no way to escape the consequences of them. The answer to the question, why is that last one there? Somebody asked me this the other day, and they said, that doesn't seem like it fits with the rest of them, because all the rest of them are about impermanence and loss, and this one's about, I'm the heir to my intentions and the karma and decision making. So why is that there? And the answer to that question is found in the first four. That if I really open my mind and my heart to the reality of the four, then I will start working with those now, and it will change my understanding of myself, of my relationships to others and loss. If I don't, I will be the heir to that. So it's about skillful practice. If I practice skillfully, these potentially can completely change how I embrace loss. And if I don't, I get the reverse. Okay. Thanks very much, huh?